Welcome to Dog Training Disrupted by Upward Dogology, where I retrain your brain and introduce you to the world of cognitive behavioral therapy for dogs over the age of 6 months. Today's show is a complete retraining of the brain. We dive deep into the psychology behind cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And to help me do this, I have licensed master social worker David J. Roberts as my guest. As you probably know, I'm a big believer in the benefits of combining professional and personal experience, and Dave has both of these in abundance. You will find this episode enlightening, informative, and a game changer. Dave is a retired addiction professional and an adjunct professor in the Psychology Child Life Department at Utica University in Utica, New York. Dave also teaches psychology classes at Pratt MWP School of Art and Design. In reference to his personal life, Dave's daughter Janine died of cancer on March 1st, 2003 at the age of 18. This experience led to a personal healing journey in which CBT was something that really helped him a lot, and he really dove into it. I would say he dove into his healing journey on many levels, and this is what makes it what his journey is so interesting. These journeys, of course, lead to many different opportunities. Dave has presented workshops at national conferences of the Compassionate Friends, as well as for the Bereaved Parents of the USA. He was also a keynote speaker at the 2011 and 2015 national gatherings of the Bereaved Parents of the USA. Dave also co-presented a workshop titled Helping Faculty After Traumatic Loss for the Parkland, Florida community in May of 2018 in the aftermath of the mass shootings at Stoneman Douglas High School. Dave has been a past HuffPost contributor and has contributed articles to Medium, Open to Hope Foundation, Mindfulness and Grief, Thrive Global, and the Recovering of Self Journal. He has also appeared on numerous podcasts as well as Open to Hope Television. In 2021, he co-authored and published a book with Reverend Patty Farino titled When the Psychology Professor Met the Minister. Ooh, I'm looking forward to reading that one. He also has created his own podcast, which has just hit the ground running. It's called the Teaching Journeys Podcast, and he uses his personal and professional experience to help others in this podcast, as well as all of his talks and appearances. Dave and I met virtually when we were both presenters at the Global Grief Conference 2023. So what does this all have to do with dogs and dog behavior? Grief, anxiety, perception, emotions, cognitive appraisal, habits. These are all intertwined with behavior. Yes, dogs feel grief. They feel grief. They feel depression. They process and make decisions. And as with humans, this leads to behavior stemming from these emotions and mindset and appraisal. Dave and I are going to chat about how CBT directly relates to these factors affecting our behavior and our ability to overcome challenges or even perceive challenges that affect not only our behavior, but our lives. And this is exactly what CBT addresses with dogs, helping to live better, more fulfilled lives. So after that lengthy introduction, I am honored to introduce you to Dave Roberts. Hey, Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Billy, it's a pleasure always to spend time with you. And thank you for that wonderful introduction. I appreciate it.
Well, it's well deserved. You are such an impactful person. And I'm so glad to share all your just thoughts and experiences and information. So let's get started right off the top. Tell us what CBT is to you, professionally and personally.
Well, professionally, and I think personally, CBT is how belief drives behavior. And with CBT, it requires us to take a look at our beliefs that have been either self-defeating, have not allowed us to achieve our goals, and make a conscious effort to challenge those beliefs and modify those beliefs so that we are engaging in pro-social behavior or productive behavior. For the clients that I worked with who primarily had issues with addiction and mental health concerns, we really talked about the beliefs that were contributing to their inability to believe that they could not embrace recovery or could not be proactive in addressing their mental health challenges. With my own personal journey with grief, it was, and especially after my daughter's transition, I refer to her death as a transition from one existence to another. It required me at the age of 47 to take a look at all of my beliefs, my attitudes, how I perceive the world. And I had to say, what beliefs are going to stay, which beliefs are going to go, which beliefs are going to be modified or expanded. And one of my earliest influences on the journey, Billy, and I have to mention this because he's got to be one of Canada's favorite sons, the late, great Neil Peart, who wrote a book called Ghost Rider on the Healing Road. And Peart, and I'm sure everybody in Canada who's listened to rock and roll knows that he was the brilliant drummer lyricist for the band Rush, who were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I believe, in 2011. And one of my death, dying, and bereavement students gave me a book by Neil Peart. And it was in a book, as I mentioned, it was called Ghost Rider. And it was about his personal journey after experiencing two catastrophic losses within a 10-month period of time. It was his daughter who died in a one car accident. I believe that was 1997. And his common law wife who died of stomach cancer about 10 months later. And he embarked on a 55,000-mile journey across Canada, Mexico, and the United States. And as he put this, to determine what kind of a person he wanted to be and what kind of a world that he wanted to live in. And in a nutshell, I had to utilize cognitive behavioral therapy to achieve the same objectives that Neil Peart did. I had to determine what kind of a person am I going to be now after following my daughter's Janine's transition and because of her physical absence, and what kind of a world do I choose to live in? And that was a process in and of itself where I had to do a lot of cognitive restructuring of my beliefs. I needed to embrace different perspectives so that it could align with my redefined world. And to me, that's what and professionally, clients need to do the same thing. They challenge their beliefs that have resulted in them engaging in non-productive behaviors and say, okay, what kind of a world do I want to live in now? How do I want to live a more productive life? How do I want to learn to live without alcohol and other drugs? How do I want to learn to be able to manage my mental health symptoms? How do I learn to empower myself to create the world of my choosing? Cognitive behavioral therapy speaks to the core of all those aspects.
Wonderful. I love how you can relate your journey to other people's journeys and how important that is, because CBT really is that. It is a journey. Now, having said that, it is an actual methodology. It does have a step-by-step process. It's just how that is done and how it is applied is individual depending on a number of factors. And of course, when we're you work with people and I work with people who work with dogs. So it follows the same guidelines. And I think one of the really important ones that you've brought up is you've talked about beliefs. And then over here, we have emotions. And then we also have behavior. And we have perception. And they're all intertwined because our beliefs affect our emotions. They're not necessarily the same thing. So, for example, with a dog, a dog could originally start out believing that a person is a horrible person. Their emotion towards them is anger. And then their behavior is reactivity. When they learn to reset their brain on that, they may or may not change their perception towards the person. They might still feel that that person is not a great person, but they're able to manage their emotions and think about how they feel and why, and do they need to do that behavior? And is their belief grounded in something realistic? It might be. We don't know. There might be a reason for it. There might not be. But the same with people. Do we need to react that way in order to be okay, in order to live safely, in order to, in fact, there's a good chance not reacting or feeling a certain way actually might make our life more fulfilling. And so doing this with working with CBT with people and with dogs to help them reach that point is a journey. It's not necessarily lengthy. It's just not a tick the boxes.
No, and it's something that when we commit, and I mean, for me, change is going to occur if the person is motivated to change and they surrender to the fact that they need to do this and that they just realize that the way they looked at the world before through the eyes of cognition and beliefs and perceptions needs to be modified. Now, you mentioned, I think within one of the things we tend to, you know, not every situation is going to be safe, but I think when we are engaging in healthy belief work, for lack of a better way to put this, we can ascertain which situations are not safe and we can act accordingly. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we need to be able to discern that. When it becomes a problem is like, let's say, for example, and I've used this example with my students, let's say you have an individual who's had a negative interaction with the law enforcement system. So now they will, because of thinking errors, and this I'm coining a term by Aaron Beck, who was one of the founders of cognitive therapy. That person may take a look at the world and say, well, because I had one negative interaction with a law enforcement officer, all law enforcement officers are bad. So therefore, I can't trust any of them. What that does is it prevents them from taking a look at their own accountability in the situation and allows them to perhaps engage in further behaviors that are going to get them in trouble because they're working with a flawed belief that all law enforcement individuals are bad. What is true is that there's some that are bad, like in any profession, and there's some that aren't. And a healthy belief would be to recognize the difference. And then your behavior is governed accordingly. But belief work requires conscious effort. It requires homework. It requires, you know, rehearsal of those new beliefs to translate into, so they can see the results of those beliefs in terms of those modified beliefs in terms of healthier behaviors. It requires a commitment on both the therapist and the individual's part to commit to work. One of the things I've read with cognitive behavioral therapy, at least minimally, 20 minutes of homework 3 times a week in terms of challenging those, you know, and prioritizing those one or two or three different beliefs that have caused individuals to not get productive outcomes or to interact in a way that for them is not positive. And so they do that through a process of disputing those beliefs. And, you know, and disputation involves what evidence is there to support the belief, what evidence is there to not support the belief, and then using that information on both sides of the coin to kind of develop a belief that's going to be more realistic and lead to more healthier behaviors and allow individuals to manage their emotions.
And what I love about that is, now with dogs, we don't necessarily set 20 minutes aside. It's more of fit into the everyday activities that we do with our dog. But what really stood out for me there is we are working, practicing the brain resetting and being okay with change and being okay with assessing things that might not go a way that we would expect or we hope or we feel is right. But we don't need, to use your example, the police officer there doing something bad in order for us to practice this and to work it. It's not about specifically dealing with that stimulus or that negative thought. It's about dealing with habits and thought patterns and restructuring our brain and our mindset in general. Yep. And the ability to do that in general. And in the end, we may or may not like the police force fully or any better, but we realize that disliking them to that extent is not necessary all the time or in our favor.
And the other thing too, and you mentioned about the stimulus, and this is kind of something that triggered, I think, an earlier discussion that we had, you know, pre-recording. One of the things we can focus on the fact, okay, that the stimulus was the police officer, which contributed to the negative reaction and generalization, all police officers are bad. But the other thing that we need to take a look at is what were the events that precipitated that? Did the person come from a home that was dysfunctional where he had arbitrary or very, not arbitrary relationships, the word I'm looking for is very uneven relationships with the authority figures in the home with their parents. So if he's learned, or she or they have learned not to trust their parents, that could generalize to all authority figures.
And teachers,
everything. So it just isn't to look at that situation in isolation. To me would be ill-advised, because we have to take a look at what contributed to his reaction or their reaction or her reaction in that particular moment. What contributed to that? What were other factors? How did history play a role in this? Whether it be in the home, right, or with his peer group, and all of that needs to be factored in when you're going to do any type of intervention regarding cognitive behavioral therapy. Because now you've got multiple authority figures that person has responded to, all of which may have conflicting beliefs or conflicting, where he's learned not to trust them. So that's just going to generalize to everything. It just may not
right.
be
right. And with dogs, we don't always know that. A lot of my clients have adopted their dog, and we don't know the history. But to your point, there are behaviors that are connected, just like with people. It might be, like as you said, it might be common that if they distrust police, that they also distrust other authoritative figures, or there might be other common behaviors that correlate with others. And we do talk about that, because rarely is it's just like with people. We have our personalities and our thoughts and our beliefs, and they may come out stronger in one particular situation or with one stimulus, but to only address that particular problem with that stimulus can be challenging. And it cannot be really getting to, by working more holistically, we can have greater success, because we're addressing not only the oomph and the highest and the most challenging time for that person or dog, but we're starting with perhaps something that's a little more comfortable or something that's slightly out of the norm, slight change, but not necessarily. And that again gets a little bit to where how it's so opposite counter conditioning, which is scientifically proven and is a method that addresses some similar issues. They focus on changing the perception of the stimulus. So it needs the stimulus present. Whereas, and a lot of times it's not even a specific stimulus. It might, you know, I know with dogs with anxiety, it's just a matter of wanting that dog to live their best life and to feel that they can be comfortable and enjoy playtime with humans. Mm-hmm. It would be, you know, different playtime, but just to be able to relax and enjoy. So they might not even be doing a particularly horrid behavior, but that ability for their brain to relax and to be comfortable and to put their brain into a place where they can enjoy more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would come back to somebody perhaps with depression, because they're not necessarily doing a bad behavior. They don't necessarily have a bad habit. It's more of a mindset, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, with depression, one of the things is that you know, their behavior is driven by a pervasive feeling of hopelessness, a lack of self-efficacy. They believe that anything they do isn't going to result in a positive outcome. It's kind of almost related to a concept called learned helplessness, where basically they have kind of accepted the fact that they are disempowered. And I don't like to use the word victim. I think that term by itself is disempowering, but where they just feel disempowered and powerless to really change what's going on with them. So, you know, from a cognitive behavioral standpoint, it's a matter of, again, challenging those beliefs and having them confront those beliefs that allow them to believe that they're disempowered. And then combining that with just some basic, you know, basic coping skills training so that they can begin to interact in the world. But here's the other thing. With males and females, depression also manifests very differently. With men, there's more of an agitative component. There's an angry component. There's an irritable component. Where with women, there's more of an affective component as far as sadness. So for a lot of time with men who are experiencing depression, they may manifest in terms of irritability, in terms of anger. I think one of the primary reasons for that is that men are really conditioned to really express sadness in any type of way that's going to give them support, because those type of feelings tap into to what they've been told as well. You know, you're gonna allow yourself to be vulnerable or weak if you express sadness or you cry. But on the other side of the coin, it might come out in irritability, it might come out in anger, and maybe further suppress those feelings through substance use as well too. So that's the other piece, you know, in terms of the behavioral component of depression can be different, you know, across genders.
Which is why it's so interesting that CBT doesn't really focus on the behavior, but on the emotions and beliefs driving that behavior. And then the mm-hmm. behavior can also in turn drive the emotion.
Yep. And the emotion can also drive the behavior. I mean, yeah. That, in other instances we can. I mean, I could be angry for whatever reason. And during grief, it's a common thing where, you know, one minute you could be doing okay, and the next minute you're just raging and you don't know why you're raging. So you got to kind of look at it. We had to look at, okay, how do we justify the anger? How do we explain this away? So I might have looked, well, geez, there was a person that really just got me upset about 3 days ago, but I didn't really make the connection until now. Now, maybe that person didn't really get me upset 3 days ago, but it's a way for me to justify the anger. It's a way for me to kind of explain the emotion away or in my way, kind of maybe feel less guilty about it. But sure, certainly emotion can drive behavior as well, too. You know, and you take a look at, and especially people who are operating in a state of really high emotion or anger, they get tunnel vision. Their ability to perceive what's going on in the environment becomes compromised because they're so caught up in the emotion.
And so exactly. Let's talk about that. I mean, that's termed cognitive appraisal, essentially, where they're appraisal of the situations, environment, surrounding, not necessarily a specific stimulus. It could just be just a general thought patterns of how they're appraising. And back to your point on someone upsetting you, that was your perception, perhaps, that person mm-hmm. upset you. anyone else in that room might not have seen it or noticed it. And that's the same with dogs. Clients are constantly saying, you know, they didn't see anything or it wasn't there. But dogs, probably more so than humans, don't do anything for no reason. There's a double negative, but it might not be apparent right there, but it is their ability to cognitively appraise and then make decisions on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that, the ability to appraise and then make decisions, and how how CBT allows us to make those better decisions.
Well, with cognitive appraisal, I think we have to take a look back at the beliefs we had that contributed to not so great decisions about our choices. So we have to really take a look at that, and we have to say, okay, how were we interpreting the world at that time that dictated the behavior? Okay, what were my beliefs at that time, and how did that govern the behavior? And then from there, it's saying, okay, it's taking that person through a process to kind of, through cognitive restructuring, which is basically just having an individual consciously modify those self-defeating beliefs and thoughts in ways that are more proactive and will lead to better results. So it's basically taking him through that to say, okay, how can I, let's say I have a belief that I believe I need to be perfection, to be a perfectionist in everything that I do, and I can't tolerate mistakes. So maybe a healthier belief would be that it's okay for me just to do my best, and that mistakes I can tolerate and learn from. So how do we get the person from a cognitive appraisal standpoint where they're becoming totally upset, guilt-ridden, anxious because they did not get a perfect outcome, to the fact that they can be okay and maybe be just disappointed that they didn't get a perfect outcome, but yet at the same time knowing that they did their best under the circumstances? So rather than be totally immobilized by the emotion, they choose just to become, they can become disappointed, which allows them to more effectively manage the emotion and also take a look at the behavior and their effort more objectively. So it's getting them to that point where they just learn how to, to realize that sometimes certain outcomes are beyond their control, at least in this instance, with perfectionism versus just doing your best, and that just doing your best can be different or can be judged differently depending on what's going on. Let me give you a quick example of that, if I may. This just came to mind.
Right.
I had a student whose father, this was years ago, whose father was diagnosed with cancer right during the semester. She was his primary caregiver, and she had to take her father to chemotherapy probably two or three times a week, and that impacted her attendance, her ability to focus. Overall, given everything she had to deal with, and given the fact that her father was, basically when you hear the term cancer, there's two things that come to mind. You're either going to live or you're going to die. You don't think of anything in between. She ended up getting, I think, like a B for the course. And then it was. But one of the things she subscribed to was this high achievement oriented focus and pressure that she placed on herself to get all A's. And again, students will do that because of the cost of tuition, and they need a high GPA to get into graduate school, to get the scholarships. And she was disappointed. She goes, "Dave, I usually do better than that." And I looked at her and I said, "Considering everything you went through for the semester, the fact that you were dealing with a life-threatening situation with a family member, that your focus was on your father, which it needed to be, the fact that you got a B, that to me is an A." I said, "You did your best. And that your best, considering what you had to deal with, your best was close to perfection under the circumstances." But yet she had subscribed to this belief that her previous appraisal of herself was that she had to be perfect in everything she did. And anything less than an A was failure. And so I had to teach her that you were successful. given everything that you, and that sometimes you're not going to get the outcome you desire because there are circumstances that are beyond your control that are going to, and don't take that personally. You did your best, mm-hmm. and that's all that matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if I were to again push this back over to dogs, it's interesting that you might take a situation in a dog park where there's a dog that is very well trained, very good dog, and gets into some aggressive minor or otherwise with other dogs. And one of the first things that I think about is commonly these dogs are very good. I mean, all dogs are very good, but I'm going to use the term well-trained just because, you know, they mm-hmm. know what's going on. They're with the program. They high up, at home, everywhere. They're with the program. Their cognitive appraisal of something like an off-leash dog park is very high. They know that there's dogs running around. They know that there's people, balls and things are flying. They can go to new situations. They're fine. But what can happen is they just feel like a dog isn't with the program, isn't how they expect it should go, isn't what they think should happen in a way that it should happen. Maybe a dog jumped on their human and they know that jumping up is wrong. And so they'll try to manage that situation, but they can't manage every situation. They can't manage every dog. They can't manage everything in their surroundings all mm-hmm. the time and have everything go exactly the way that it should go. It just doesn't happen. And so what we do is, back to your example, very similar, where we would give them the ability to reset their brain, process changes that happen that don't always go the way that they think they should go. We're not setting them up for failure. We're not setting them up to be stressed, because they're essentially very stable dogs, very stable, mm-hmm. very well balanced. But this way they can just have their brain process something that I'm not happy with this, or this isn't going how it should, or this isn't really the way that my life is supposed to be, and be okay with it. Be okay with it in the sense that they don't have to change it to be okay.
Yeah, they can just learn to manage it and do the best that they can.
Yeah.
I think there's a book by Don Miguel Ruiz called The Four Agreements. And he said, if we could live our life through four basic principles, we'd be very fulfilled and very content. One of those is don't take things personally. The other thing is always do your best. And those are two that I can think of right off the top. But I've told clients, I said, if we could learn to live by those four basic beliefs, the process of cognitive appraisal would be so easy. I mean, we wouldn't put so much pressure on ourselves. We wouldn't complicate it. We would understand the basis behind those. And sometimes the things that are not outside of our control that we can just manage the best that we can. And sometimes being able to manage a situation effectively can be better than completely resolving that situation. You know, it's learning just how to manage it. Because certain things are going to go away, but you can still manage the intensity. You can manage the amount of exposure you have to a particular situation. You can determine what's going to be part of your life experience and what isn't going to be part of your life experience. And if we're able to engage in healthy cognitive appraisal, we can make those decisions without guilt and, you know, without any second guessing or regrets.
Now that's interesting. Now dog training has taken a lot of terminology and concepts from psychology and scientifically proven methods and sort of move them over. And one of those is coping.
Mm-hmm.
And I struggle with this one on how they've brought it over, because it's almost as though it's become this, you know, coping mechanisms are not always rehabilitation when it comes to the dog world. So, for example, it becomes more the person's ability to cope by, for example, if the dog loses his mind out the front window when something goes by, we'll just close your blinds. That's not the dog learning to cope. That is, you know, or they'll restrict or restrain, or even with dogs with high anxiety, they'll just convince themselves that the dog is happier not going anywhere and not doing anything. So there is a line between, a difference between coping mechanisms that are restrictive and ones which allow the dog or the person to realize where their own limitations are, but also work on that, because humans do have to be part of society to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. I mean, if their coping mechanism is to never leave the home, that is probably not healthy and not good. They have to be coping mechanisms that allow for freedom of choice and happiness and a life that they can live. Now, that doesn't mean that they necessarily have to address all their issues or the big ones, but we do want to start addressing some of these anxieties and fears so that they can live a well-rounded life.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I think coping mechanisms need to help the individual engage more proactively in the world as opposed to restrict them. There are certain coping mechanisms that can help, like thought stopping is another cognitive therapy technique where you would tell a person, think of your most self-defeating thought that has gotten in the way, interfered with your behavioral goals. Let me know when that comes to the surface, and then we yell stop. And we teach the individual how to kind of just consciously stop the thought. Now, what that requires is for the individual to allow that thought to surface. But what I tell them is that if we can break up your time in like an hour increments, and you basically can thought stop for 5 or 10 minutes out of that 60 minutes and gradually increase it, and you're making progress.
Yes.
You're making progress, and it's not so much restrictive as it is, it makes them aware. But I would agree with that. Pulling the blinds down is basically, that's the person's belief system being imposed on the expectations of the dog. And one of the things that I've been thinking about since our conversation, so I wonder how much of the beliefs that dog owners have about the world impact their dog's behavior, because dogs are very energy sensitive. They're very intuitive from what I've discovered. So unless an individual goes into some really, really serious cognitive appraisal or reappraisal or cognitive restructuring, they're going to take their beliefs, those negative beliefs that they have about the world, they're going to impose them on the dog, and the dog therefore is going to be a mirror of that. I mean,
that's a very to use a common word, but popular conversation and topic that comes up in the dog world a lot. And I get asked that a lot because people wonder if I just do that, if I simply, you know, say to people, you need to relax, you need to be happier, you need to be calm, and I work with the people. I work with the people, but I never tell them that. Never.
No.
I provide them with skills that allow them to work with their dog. And when they can see changes in their dog and they feel a change in dynamics, they feel a change in the bond between them and their dog, they feel more confident and comfortable what to do in situations, what exercises to do. When they see their dog thinking cognitively and making different decisions, even if it's not at the highest, you know, what they hired me to fix, but just in general, then they inherently are calmer and they're inherently happier and more in tune with their dog. So that is a really a big topic in the dog world, because there's, I agree that dogs do feed off your energy, but it's incredibly challenging to not feel anxious when, you know, a dog is approaching you on your leash walk and you know that your dog is highly reactive. I mean, we need to start back and build the skills and, you know, approach that, so that by the time that we get there and are what, which again, doesn't have to be a long time, but it has to go in these steps. Then all of a sudden, just the fact that they see improvement and they have skills and they have a game plan. And then the dog feels that energy. The dog knows that they know what they're doing. That's the other thing that's interesting, is it's not just the perception of, and same with people, I believe, and you know, chime in on this, not just the perception of the stimulus or the area, but also the perception of their ability to have choices, and the perception of perhaps the person they're with. Can they manage this? So with dogs, the perception of their person being able to calmly manage, understand what's in their head, understand what's important to them, understand why they feel this need to feel fear. So, you know, maybe if someone is traveling and they're fearful of crowds and new places and everything is different, but the person they're with understands that this is fearful to them and knows how to calmly manage that. Not necessarily tell them what to do, but just calmly manage the situation. Perhaps they know the language. Perhaps they know how to do the money exchange. They know how the subway system works there. This is going to decrease the fear and anxiety in the person, because it's okay, the person I'm with has some about amount of ability to manage situations that I feel I can't.
And I think you're right. I think a lot of times people perceive, and again, this is based on history, this is based on any past dysfunction that they've emanated from, where they believe that they don't have choices. We do have choices. I can not make a choice, and that's a choice.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, I cannot make a choice, and that's a choice.
And that's different than presenting options and making people or dogs choose an option. You know, go left or go right, take the blue ball or the red ball. Decisions, decisions are solely your own.
And I tell my students, is that every behavior you engage in has a natural consequence attached to it. So make sure you're aware of the consequences, choose wisely, and also be prepared to be accountable for the consequences that your behavior has on yourself and others. I said, but choose wisely. You know, take a look at both the yin and the yang and decide which path that you want to take. And we have free choice. We have free will. We can do whatever. When people say, well, I can't do this. Sure, you can. You can do whatever you please, but just be aware of the consequences. And I think once people realize that they're empowered, that they do have choice, that they don't need to rely on any individuals for external validation, they can rely on them for feedback as opposed to advice, and choose to determine what they need to do with that. I think
good point. Feedback as opposed to advice. That's very good.
Yeah, I'll tell you why I don't give advice, Billy, and this is something. If I gave you advice, let's say, for example, I gave you advice on how to resolve a specific work dilemma that you might have had with a colleague. That advice works. Who do you credit for the advice? You credit me, because it was my advice that worked. It wasn't anything that you did. So automatically, you've disempowered yourself, because you believe you relied on me and your advice, as opposed to, well, you know, I had the choice to take his suggestion or not take his feedback. I did it and it worked. It wasn't solely because of his feedback. It was my role in that. But now if it goes south, who do you got to blame? Well, and so that's why I tell students, don't give advice, give feedback, give suggestions, and always put the ball in the other person's court. You can go left, you can go right, you can go down the middle. these are your options. These
or
are
you can stand exactly where you are and take neither of those and just hang tight.
You can do nothing.
Yeah. Well, doing nothing is doing something. These are all decisions. And if you need longer to make that decision, or you need more information, or you need a better ability to process your surroundings and process your potential options or what decision you're going to make. And I think that's very important with dogs as well, that it's not all about telling them right from wrong or encouraging right behavior and discouraging wrong behavior. With puppies, we need to do that. And with young children, we need to teach before we can expect to just provide general guidance, often called parenting, or general guidance, which is what I'm very similar with the way I work with my clients is what you just said, is I don't tell them a step-by-step process on what is right and what is wrong. Once they understand the skills and once we've taught the skills, then it's a matter of applying them and being creative on that and being creative on how we apply them so that we're not just teaching right from wrong.
And if in the world of therapy, if I told a client that this is what you had to do and I insisted on that, I'm engaging in pretty much unethical practice, because with any type of code of ethical conduct, whether it's for any health professional or human service professional, client has the right to self-determine, client has the right to autonomy, client has the right to choose, the client has the right to dictate what treatment interventions they are going to be comfortable with and what they're not. So basically, if I'm enforcing my will on a client that you have to do something, and not allowing them to appraise the situation for themselves, keeping it into the, not allow them to make their own cognitive appraisal based on free will, I've engaged in unethical practice, and I could be sued, I could lose my job, and it just all just from a human.
But even aside,
what isn't right?
It's not right, and it's the same with dogs. I mean, it's an unregulated industry; we don't get sued, but it doesn't work. It just doesn't work with some dogs. Now, with anyone who's listened to my podcast knows the big differentiation between dogs under 6 months and over. But it also just, with a lot of dogs, it's like with people. If you're telling them right from wrong, as opposed to providing them with the skills to make those decisions, if they make what we consider to be, or what society considers to be, the wrong decision, let's backtrack here. Let's revisit why. Why are they still making these? Why are they still uncomfortable? Why are they still angry or depressed? And let's go back and build some more skills that allow them once again on their own to say, whoosh, right. I don't need to do that, or I don't need to feel that way, or is that really important? And to question it based on practicing their brain doing that for themselves. So it's an interesting blend, because like I said, in my profession it's unregulated. We could, and I do get clients saying to me, Billy, just tell me what to do, just what do I do in this situation? And it's not that I'm going to get sued, it's that it truthfully really works a lot better if they understand the overall whole on what they're trying to do, because my answer today is going to be different 4 days, 10 days, 3 weeks from now, because the dog is going to have progressed and changed, and their viewpoint has changed, and their emotions and their mind, their mindset has changed. Mm-hmm. So I can see why it's illegal and unethical in a profession such as yours, but also it just can be counterproductive and ineffective.
Yeah, I mean, you know, asking somebody like, you know, for me, it'd be like, what if the situation I was more just trying to force my will as a therapist on somebody else and say, this is how you need to do this. Now, if somebody asks me, what do you think I should do? I'll turn it back on and say, well, what do you think you need to do? What is your gut telling you? Because One of the things, whether, and I, you know, I know one of the things that people, regardless of the amount of crisis that they're in, the amount of coping skills that they may require, the amount of cognitive appraisal or reappraisal that they need to do to reset their brain and learn to live productively in a world where they've learned how to manage whatever difficulties or challenges that they have had, just it's basically they have some existing strengths that they brought into that situation, regardless of their dysfunction. So let's find out, what are your inherent strengths? What do you feel you bring to the table? Let's help you discover those. Let's utilize those in the process of building those coping skills. Let's utilize your strengths to strengthen your ability to objectively appraise and assess situations and make what is the appropriate choice for you, not for me, but for you in that situation. But what we in the world of therapy, a lot of times it's about diagnosis, and diagnosis tells an individual what they can't do, but it doesn't tell you what they can do. So tell me, I know what your diagnosis is, but tell me, regardless of that, your diagnosis, what strengths do you bring to the table? What can we use to incorporate into your individualized care plan, into your treatment plan, into your long and short-term goals that can help you achieve positive outcomes and see the world differently?
I love that. Before I even knew what CBT was, anyone who's listened to any talk I've been on will know that I actually developed my methodology from working with dogs and then later learned it adhered to CBT. But this is something that's always been very important to me, is learn what the dog knows. People bring in a dog into their life, whether they're a foster home and or adopter, and the first thing they do is start to teach. You know, use treats to teach and sit and things like this. The first thing I do is learn what the dog knows.
Mm-hmm.
Learn, and that's not that challenging. And if I'm working with a client, I'll ask the client what their dog knows. Daily schedule, like, what is it that you do? And sometimes they're answering the question thinking I'm, you know, rating their dog. I'm not. I'm going to pull information from what they're telling me and use it. And I refer back to it throughout our whole time together. Remember you told me that your dog could do this or did this, or remember this routine that you have down packed? Well, that actually involves this cognitive skill and this cognitive skill. So let's pull off that, because your dog's automatically making those decisions and using that side of his brain and making him comfortable with that or likes that or knows that. Let's pull off that and build off of it. So it's so important to respect. I like what you said, where it's not about what they can't do or where their fear is. And assessment's a big thing too. I mean, people will say to me, can you just meet my dog and see what he does? Well, I know what he does because you already told me what he does. Let's work together and see what changes occur once we work together, because you can tell me what he normally would have done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one's going to lie if their dog would normally have lost his mind or bit or peed or whatever. If that's what the dog normally would have done, I believe them. But let's start somewhere and build and apply and then see what the changes are.
Yep. And assessment is the keystone to doing good work in any field. If you've done a thorough assessment, if you've had the opportunity to observe the person, and I guess I can even say the dog that you're working with in a variety of different settings, it gives you a total perception of what specific triggers in certain situations are going to trigger certain behaviors, and you can develop a plan to individually deal with each of those triggers based on the situation and make them situation specific. As far as,
and that's why I can work virtually, because I can ask the people that those questions, or they take me on their journey with them through their device.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not so much the bad behavior that the dog would do. We also might work in the off leash park, which is perhaps one of the best places that the dog loves, their favorite place. But what I'm picking up on is what their choices are when they're making good choices. Mm-hmm. And can they follow a basic command in the off-leash park that they could at home, that they could somewhere else? You know, how does their brain work in excitable places versus calm places, and build off of that and practice skills everywhere?
And, you know, it's like another situation I just kind of thought about was I've had individuals tell me, well, I'm not assertive. I have trouble being assertive, you know, verbalizing my needs, listening to the other person's needs very constructively, not attacking, not being passive. And then I'll give them like a survey that check off the situations that you feel you need to be more assertive in. They don't check off every box, Billy. So when I take a look at it, you told me that you don't have the ability to be assertive. Now, that would be a general global cognitive appraisal that says you're not assertive in any situations yet. You left these boxes unchecked. So what does that tell you? What is if I were you and you were me, what would you say to me? Well, maybe there were certain situations that I was assertive. Okay, fine. Let's take a look at where you were successful, why you were successful. And let's take a look to see if the skills that you use in that situation could be transferred or generalized to other situations where you're having difficulty being assertive. Can we identify very common core skills that could work from one situation to the next?
Yeah, and a lot of that is the brain and the mindset. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, where is your brain? Where's your mindset? What does your body do? What, you know, and just changing that mindset and practicing changing that mindset when you go into these places. That's so interesting. On a personal note, just yesterday, I'm taking this PhD program and it's in Sweden. So the time change, it's in the middle of the night. I'm tired. And I had a presentation to do. Obviously, I'm somewhat comfortable in this field because it's in cognition and emotions, mm-hmm. and animal welfare. So it's in my wheelhouse big time. But it's also the first PhD course that I've taken, and it's online, and you know, everyone else in there has, you know, former scholastic. So I would put that as sort of, okay, my mindset has to be confident and assertive, but I have to practice that, and I have to, but I know I can do it. And then literally when that was finished in the morning, I went for a run. Well, runs for me, I nail them. They're great. They're easy. I know the neighborhood I'm going through and the park. And, you know, it's just like a total comfort. Where's my brain there? You know, what makes that such a relaxed thing for me, right? And then same with clients, meeting clients or online. You know, so people would think when I'm running and with clients that, oh, she's assertive, she's confident. Well, then not an hour later, I'm at the dentist. I'm terrified of the dentist. You know, it's not a comfort zone. I don't go. I floss every day simply to avoid going to the dentist. But I had to go. And I had to really concentrate on breathing. How do I breathe when I run? How do I concentrate on breathing when I'm running or when I'm delivering a presentation where I'm somewhat nervous, but I know I can do it? And so taking these skills and my mindset and all of those and taking it to the dentist, this is all within 4 hours or 5 hours, right? So just what you were saying was making me think of that.
Yeah, I tell my dentist, because I have a periodontist because I had some gum issues in the past, and I tell them I don't like pain, so just numb me up when you're cleaning, you know. Yeah, and they know that, so that's kind of, you know, it makes going
it's
to
a
the
coping strategy.
It's a coping strategy. Yeah, numb me up. Yeah, you know, pain is not my friend in this situation. So you know,
so you know what works for you.
Yeah, I know. And part of, I think, with cognitive appraisal is knowing your limitations and being okay with that. And saying,
Well, see, that's funny that the dentist assumed that it was pain that I was afraid of. I'm not. Needles don't bug me. Pain doesn't bother me. It's more my thought in my brain, I am going to have a hard time breathing and swallowing.
Yep.
So it really had nothing to do with the pain. It had to do with, am I going to be able to, and it makes no sense because people go to the dentist all the time and they breathe and swallow. So there must be a way to do this. And I had to literally take the breathing and the all those there. But I do want to switch a little bit here. And I want to talk, you've mentioned a couple times about with back to your own personal experience and Noom. I love this, how you use Noom as an example in comparison perhaps to other eating plans such as Jenny Craig that might use something different. So I want to skip to that to that because I like the way you talk on this. So go for it.
Okay. Well, on February 10th, 2021, and I remember the date because that was kind of my day of reckoning and the turning point for me. It was during the pandemic. I had ballooned, and I was always heavy. I always had issues with weight, issues with being overweight, ever since I can remember. February 10th, I weighed 252 and a quarter pounds.
Oh my gosh, people, if you could see him now, that's hard to believe.
Yeah, I was not managing. I was eating, I was living to eat as opposed to eating to live.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and essentially any type of stress trigger, boredom trigger, happiness trigger was associated with food. And growing up, food was a big part of my culture. It was a big part of my upbringing. I'm half Lebanese, and I remember, my mother would make enough food. I mean, you and a friend could come over, Billy, every three of us, you'd have a banquet table laid out with food. So food was a big part of my culture. It was expected that if you came to my house, you were going to eat something. And also that you were going to leave your plate. You were going to leave a morsel on your plate. So this is what I had. Food had a lot of positive triggers for me. I also learned how to use food as a stress reliever and everything else. And particularly after my daughter's Janine transition, food became probably a source of comfort. It became a source of maybe, filling in some of the empty moments. But to jump to February 10th, 2021, I looked at my wife, Sherry, and said, I got to do something. I said, I cannot fit into two set pairs of size 38 pants I bought 6 months ago. Something has got to give. In the meantime, I was talking to my son, Dan, who had told me about Noom. He said, it's a really great plan. So I looked into it. I filled out a few basic questions. They came up with a calorie plan. I told them, this is how much weight I wanted to lose. I had set a goal of like 52 pounds. I answered some questions. They set up a plan for me. Here's how many calories you could have per day. Here's how long it's going to take for you to do this, to lose the weight if you stay with the plan. Thing I liked about Noom, you know how some plans will say eliminate carbohydrates, eliminate junk food, but Noom was about balance. You could have, they categorized the green foods, which were very high in nutritional value and low in caloric content, yellow foods, which were kind of a little higher, medium, caloric content and a little less nutritional value, and the red foods, which is the junk food. And they put it in balance. You know, you could have so many calories of red foods, so many calories of green foods. And obviously it was to have more greens and yellow foods than red foods, but you weren't deprived of anything. You were pretty much empowered.
So there's your decision making putting some of it on you instead of being telling you exactly.
Yeah, they assigned me an individual coach and a group coach who checked in with me. I logged my workouts, I logged my meals, I weighed myself every day, which they suggested. And I questioned that because weight tends to fluctuate. But let's say, for example, if I gained a pound the next day, for a lot of individuals who engage in black and white thinking or dichotomous thinking, where, oh, geez, one day where I gained weight means I blew my diet, so I might as well just yeah. you know, blow the whole thing. Noom emphasized her mantra, progress, not perfection. So for somebody who is a perfectionist, that immediately reset my brain to say, okay, if I gain a pound, it's not the end of the world. It's what I do over the long term. They also gave you articles every day to read that kind of reset your brain. It allowed you to kind of change, empower you to change your triggers with food. Like one of the things I recommended, don't put away all the junk food. If your wife, if somebody in your house wants to eat junk food, let them eat it. You have to learn how to manage that because you're going to find it elsewhere. So they gave you tips in terms of how to manage those situations and apply that. And soon it just became second nature. I got down to 200 pounds by July of 2022. And then I just stayed on the Noom plan. I've been on it ever since. Turns out 200 wasn't my ideal weight, about between 177 and 180 is. And that's where I've stayed now for the last year and a half.
And congratulations.
Thank you. And I exercise regularly. I have my own little workout room. I exercise at home. I walk. I do the elliptical. I do, you know, light weight training. And a healthy brain, healthy body leads to a healthy mind. And I've really seen the difference. And I feel better now, Billy, at almost age 68 than I ever did at age 36 or 47. You know, just, you know, and that's, but it's because I made the conscious choice to do cognitive appraisal, reset my brain, particularly in terms of how I viewed my relationship with food. And it's worked.
And I think that's where I was going with Noom, where it's, they do provide you with the basic skills, just like with CBT, you get your basic skills and your knowledge on what works with that particular individual. So they asked you those questions that allow them to come up. So it is about, I mean, it is a formula. You know, you do have to decrease your caloric intake, you know, to do that. And then they give you a way to do that. So very similar with, you know, how I work with dogs or CBT in general, where there is skill set that you apply that achieves goals. And then once that's achieved, it moves over to the mindset more than anything. Whereas some other, I think, I always think too, if people have a weight problem and it's 100% to do with lack of knowledge, they just literally don't know that a bag of potato chips has more calories than an apple and what that literally means when they eat it and what's going on, then they could do completely fine with just education. Here's education, right from wrong, good from bad. Do this, eat this day. Just some people are like that. Tell me what to eat in a day. Tell me what to do. And I don't really need to have the larger picture. But I think when people have the skills and then they start to see changes, and that changes their mindset, and then they feel like, yes, they can do it, then it actually becomes more of a, they're able to own it, so to speak. They're owning those life decisions and those, they're owning the ability to say, I'm choosing today to eat a red product. I'm choosing to do that. Because my wife just made a really wonderful, you know, cake for our friend. It's their birthday and I'm going to participate. So I'm choosing to do that. And I'm well aware of it is different than what you talked about earlier, where everything was just food. Everything was food. Everything was food. Every activity, whether every emotion, happy, sad, good, bad, depressed, happy, whatever was food. You're making more cognitive decisions, educated, but also emotional.
Yep.
You know, you're emotionally thinking, I'm happy in this situation. We're celebrating somebody, something that my wife made a cake for. And I'm well aware that I'm eating this in celebration of this and I'm fine with that.
Yeah. I mean, and Noom worked for me. For somebody else, it could be just, like you said, basic education. It could be WW. Yeah. It could be Jenny Craig. It's what works for you. Noom was really for me the program, the formula, the intervention that I needed to. And essentially, I had lost weight before, but I was never able to maintain it because, you know, I never really went through the whole cognitive appraisal behind my decisions to eat. And once I began to take a look at the reasons I was eating certain foods and when, and to just reset my brain and reevaluate those triggers and learn to manage those triggers more effectively, the way I eat now has become second nature.
Right. And that's exactly what I do with dogs. And people said that, how do you do that with a dog? But they have cognitive skills. They have emotions. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of knowing how to do that. But that is, and again, some dogs would take better to, some people would take better. I mean, the industry has, made people's brains think conditioning, because that's all that's in the dog world. So they conditioned them to like conditioning. Mm-hmm. But dogs like different methods, just like people. Exactly what you just said. Something else might work for someone else. And it might just be the time in their life, too. Mm-hmm. Like you said, conditioning or, the other methods that are more in line with conditioning, you did lose the weight on those. It just didn't work in the long run. But it wasn't like they didn't work at all. They did.
Mm-hmm. It just wasn't enough to sustain. And depending on where you're at in your journey, an intervention that may work at an earlier part of your journey isn't going to apply in the next part of your journey. You might need something more. It's the same with grief. What I took comfort from, in early grief are different now in the middle of later grief because I've evolved. I've evolved and there's a time and place for everything, but there isn't a one size fits all solution to every situation. And, not across our developmental stages of our life, we need to, depending on what's being manifested, we need to apply the intervention that's going to make the most sense for us and for the individual.
That's well said right there. So from there, tell us about your podcast, where people can find it, and your
information. Well, the podcast is the Teaching Journeys podcast. You can find it. You can find it on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Pandora Radio, just any place that podcasts are available. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can email me at bootsyandangel@gmail.com.
That will be in the show notes.
Yep. People. And, my social media contacts, my social media contacts. So you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. If you're interested in finding out more about the book I co-authored with Reverend Patty Farino, When the Psychology Professor Met the Minister, you can go to Amazon Canada, anywhere Amazon is available. Or also go to our author dedicated website, thepsychologyprofessorandminister.com. So that's how you can find me.
You're everywhere. That is great. You've had such inspirational accomplishments and your knowledge is greatly appreciated. Thank you so much for joining us. And as I said, all of those will be on the show notes, and also credit to musicians. And please listen to the other episodes if some of this was resonated with you, with CBT for your dogs or for yourself. And any questions, please feel free to reach out. And thank you so much, Dave.
Billy, my pleasure as always. Hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Always enjoy speaking with you. Thank you, everyone, and enjoy your learning journey.